Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around for another episode of This Life. I'm telling you, it's been a good couple of episodes here.
let me get a little business out of the way. Please, everybody, check out me and Lawrence Vaughn on KBC 790 Midday Live Talk Radio Program. We have that up at drdrew.com. Also at kbc.com. Also join the email list at drdrew.com. Get the weekly opium series as well. We're going to do a narcissism series, explain why we are all so crazy in this country and why the tribalism.
And, so a little narcissism is good. I'm going to argue that all the time.
I told you. No.
You don't get Bob Dylan if you don't get narcissism.
Bob, no argument for me. That's one of the things I'm going to teach people is that it's not a pejorative. It has a liability.
Yes.
Okay. And the liability is what we're dealing with right now.
Is the recovery industry.
And we have a new product that we are getting behind called Genotex from the Genotox Lab. Genotox, rather.
It's the genetic, so you know that the urine is of the person.
Exactly. So you check the DNA from the cheek swab and you make sure that pee has the urine, the DNA from the person.
That could put a lot of phony outpatients out of business.
And I like the way Bob wants to deal with it. Like, I've got my Genotox swab here. Is there anything you want to tell me?
When they go in the bathroom with a cup of urine.
Is there anything we need to talk about? And also our friends
doesn't
at Heal.
Doesn't feel warm enough. Are you sure this is yours?
Our friends at Heal, they, of course, will come to your house within 2 hours. Go to heal.com.
You know how many cold cups of urine I've been given?
Oh, listen,
you can just feel it and go, dude, come on. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Do you think I was born yesterday?
The pH is
what about the Wizinator?
The Wizinator.
Drew brought that up on a prior episode. We haven't even introduced you yet. You can't talk.
Guest. I'm sorry.
This is Amy, my friend Amy. She doesn't know she's a comedian. She was a comedian. Now she's an author of My Fair Junkie. Awesome. She's also one of the funnest people in Hollywood for the last 20
editor,
years.
Contributor to The Fix, fix.com.
Well, let's not get into that.
No?
What? Yes. Why? 6 years.
I know, but you write great articles. I'm just, I have a problem with The Fix.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean.
Oh, I didn't know
it's
that.
It's owned by Rehab.
Oh. Not anymore. He sold it.
Oh, did he?
He sold the Rehab.
Oh, okay. Oh, he sold the Rehab.
Maybe I shouldn't be even. Oh, God. You always get me in trouble, Bob. You always make me
with
say.
With her publisher, I'm going to get her in trouble.
Oh, God. There
so
goes that
anyways,
writing
just so you know, I put in a closed, what's it called when you have an envelope with a bid in it? That's what they did for The Fix. It's like a, you know, it was
closed
bankrupt.
Bid.
So
oh.
What do they do?
Auction.
Yeah. And you have to put
auction.
In an envelope what you're willing to pay. And the other rehab paid more.
Well, that's
so
interesting.
Anyways, it's insider.
So thing. Amy, your story.
She's yes. an author. She's an
well,
author.
But the My Fair Fix, or My Fair Rehab, or My Fair Addiction story's got to be intense, I'm imagining.
Well, it was.
Let him get the book right. Where is it?
My Fair Junkie.
Yes. My Fair Junkie.
Well, what it is she and I have parallel universes. We've crossed paths through the years. She was
MacArthur Park was, back in the day.
No. Beverly Hills AA.
Not that bad.
Beverly Hills AA. And Rehab World.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so, and it, you know, and I've always felt like she's a kindred spirit. She's like me. She argues about everything. Wow. And now this last go round, how much are you sober now?
5.5 years.
5.5 years. So 5.5, 6 years ago, something broke in her. And now she talks the talk and pretty much more orthodox.
Oh, good.
Right?
What's the main
Wouldn't
drug?
Wouldn't you say that?
Stimulants?
How did you know?
Keeps you thin. Keeps you thin.
Yeah.
Eating and sex, though, too.
No,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, I had an eating disorder before I picked up drugs. Then I picked up meth. Did that for 2 years. Developed grand mal epilepsy, which I still have 15 years later.
Yeah.
Hyperactive lesions on my frontal lobe. Mm. Yeah. So, but that didn't keep me from shooting cocaine a couple of years later. But
that's not meth. That's what I
was like.
Right
it's natural.
Yeah,
it's not made from gun blowing, right?
It's an interesting move. How come you didn't smoke it?
Oh, which?
The
shooting
cocaine.
The coke.
Yeah.
Oh, why'd you shoot the coke?
Because if you're going to go to Uruguay, would you take a rickshaw or a rocket? Like, let's get to where we're going.
Well, were you shooting the meth?
No.
No.
I was never.
That's the interesting move.
Well, okay, because when you go to enough rehabs, it's almost like the learning annex for drug addicts. And then all of a sudden you relapse and you get, you know, you party with someone who's like been a junkie for 20 years. And they're like, why are you snorting it? Why don't you shoot it? It uses less. It's much better. And then
from Beverly Hills.
Yeah, by that point you're like, well, why not?
Right.
So,
at least not heroin.
Yeah, so I was shooting coke, but I was having seizures, so I shot coke in a bike helmet. That is a true story.
You know what?
Bike helmet?
In a bike helmet. In case you had a
seizure. So I wouldn't crack my head open if I had a seizure.
Because the cocaine's even more likely to cause seizure than the
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
It does cause seizures, but not as bad.
That's like an overdose. Like,
well,
yeah.
Cocaine induces seizures. Meth causes seizures.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So do you have seizures on the cocaine?
Yeah. But that's why I wore a bike helmet, so I didn't crack my head open.
I'm imagining it wasn't the initial move with the bike.
She was an all the way gal. Is that, can we be clear?
All the way in.
So right? then, yeah. But then I had a couple seizures back to back, and I was just kind of like, I think I'm going to die. I think I might actually end up
paralyzed.
Did
that make you get sober?
Yeah, it did.
Oh, my gosh.
So two seizures back to back scared me.
That's Drew's favorite motivation to get sober.
What's the one?
Real comprehensive.
But I didn't stay sober. I did not stay
sorry,
sober.
Sorry, but
you
I
stayed
know-
sober 8 years.
Seven years without AA.
Seven
correct.
Years, yeah.
I know you don't like AA anymore.
So she so when somebody says I believed I was going to die and they really believed it, then they're workable. Then they become somebody.
Yeah, I was really scared.
Yeah,
and I never could moderate my use, and I was never functional as a drug addict either. So the book opens with me being arrested for felony domestic violence. I was high on OxyContin. And
oh, we
I
got
was,
some opiates in here too.
Yeah, so I got.
Huh, tell me about that.
You got to go all the way, dude.
I got something called frozen shoulder, which is something you get when you're like an inactive skinny Jew in your 40s, I guess.
Really?
And
just freezes up?
Yeah.
Like a
it's
old football
so
injury?
It's, it like capsulitis.
It's called tendonitis. Yeah, I've got it all the time.
Oh. Yeah. And I couldn't lift my arm, and I would just cry at night. And they gave me Norco, and that didn't do it. And then they gave me Oxy. And Oxy made me very aggressive, obviously. And so I pulled a knife on my now ex-husband while I was really high, and I went to jail. And that's the beginning of the book.
I understand that, but I've been a part of it from far before. So what I want to know is at what age did you go to your first 12-step meeting and or outpatient rehab?
24.
And at what age did you get sober?
Which time?
Now, this time.
Which
this time?
This time.
43.
So
it's the journey that I'm interested in. I want people to know when their loved ones, mostly loved ones of addicts, listen to this show. Okay. And they're always hoping this week, and it's going to be magical, and they're going to be sober the rest of their life, and they're going to have a wedding, and it's going to be great, and they're going to Stanford, and everything's great. And I always try to like tone that down. This is a journey for them, your daughter, your husband, your family member, not you. And it takes time, and I like them to hear these varying stories.
I've been in six rehabs. My experience was...
For alcoholics, it takes the average. This is
okay, so Drew's got the data. Right, here's the real hardcore data.
Yeah.
Wait till they get to the opiates part of this. It's going to be awful.
Well, I just have the alcoholic data. It's from John Kelly at Harvard, and it is 4 treatments, 5 years to get 1 year of sobriety.
Ooh.
That's average.
Ooh.
Four treatments, five years.
To meetings all the time and feeling guilty and ashamed. That whole 5 years, lying to all your family members that you're sober, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Ooh. Yeah, parents don't want to hear that. And that's only about alcohol, which is the most successful drug to recover from.
Right.
And when you go to opiates, Drew, what do you think that number is?
I think Amy's pretty much got it.
6 to 10.
Yeah, then 10 years and right.
But I didn't really like Oxy, and I titrated right off it. And that wasn't it. And then I started drinking Four Loko, and then I started going, you know, it was like I went back to booze. I was too scared to shoot coke anymore. I was too scared to touch meth because I had epilepsy. And so I've sort of, you know, touched them all, but it was like I would have 3 years
sober. Didn't somebody try to say do marijuana and then you won't have seizures?
I tried CBD oil. I did try CBD oil, and it didn't work.
Somebody did say it.
It did not work on me. But you know, I would get like 3.5 years sober and then I'd relapse. And it's not that I necessarily thought it would be different. I would be in so much pain, I didn't care.
Pain from what?
Emotional pain. I just, life. I didn't know how
psychic
to function.
Pain.
You know, I just didn't know how to function. And it was like, I want to check out. I need a check out. Yeah. And then finally I had, I got arrested. I lost everything. You know, my Beverly Hills princess. You know, and then all of a sudden I'm on Medi-Cal disability sweeping on a chain gang, sweeping the trash, nice. Sweeping trash. Yeah, nice. It was, you know, me and 40 Mexican guys. They're like, what you here for, Weta? I'm here Weta, for DUI.
Weta, just so you know, is what I was called also. That means
you're Weta. She was
Weta.
And I was like, I'm here for what you want, domestic Weta? Violence. And they were like, whoa. And I had an epiphany sweeping the streets.
Of
and
Hollywood Boulevard, shift. By the way. This is the perfect Hollywood story, Drew. Yeah. She was working for the Hollywood Beautification Project on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
At 6, you had to be there at 6, what, 7, seven in the morning?
7 a.m. on the dot.
A princess from Beverly Hills has to be at Hollywood Boulevard with a broom sweeping Hollywood Boulevard.
That's what got through to you.
Yeah, I really, first of all, I got there and they were like, you've swept before, right? And I was like, well, I've swept privately. I mean, I've never swept publicly.
I've wept, but not swept.
I'm more of a private sweeper, like the Tina Turner song. They were so unamused by me.
They didn't even know what she was talking. She was telling them. She was doing stand-up bits for them, and they didn't even know what she was talking about.
When you did stand-up, what kind of stuff was your routine?
It was all about my ex.
Yes,
and
I went
all
a couple times.
Drugs
it was,
and being
she
a
is really
wife.
Funny, Drew. Really funny.
And everyone's like, go back to stand up. But I just, you know, now I can be funny and deliver a message. I want to get into speaking, and I am getting into speaking. And to me, I have something to say that I think is important and life saving. And if you can make it funnier, all the better. People can hear it better. Mm-hmm. It's more digestible. They're mm-hmm. open. It breaks down the stigma, all that kind of stuff. I don't want to just be funny for funny.
Yeah.
But you were funny. See, we did a podcast a couple of weeks ago.
God, we were so out of control.
And one of the things was I saw her do a thing at the Comedy Store just like on a weekday night. And Amy could shoot down hecklers within her bit like very few people can, especially
incorporated to the punchline.
Yeah, it was like you were like a ninja. And I think that part of maybe is fear of doing it, or I don't know, or why would you be doing it? If you were doing stand up out of an insecure place, which a lot of comedians do it from a very insecure place, wanting to be loved, wanting to be liked, wanting whatever. Oh yeah, it's Elvis's school calling. I'm sure there's some important LAUSD thing going on. What? They call you every 2 hours. The schools. It's ridiculous. So. If you're doing it, if you've always done stand up, because she's an excellent stand up, and it came up that she wants to be more of a lecturer, integrate comedy into lecturing about addiction and stuff. And I saw it as kind of some unresolved thing about stand up, because you're so good at it. I'm not bullshitting.
Obviously,
he talked about it the whole time. The other thing, he's like, you're the most incredible sober stand up female stand up.
No,
in
she
the world.
Just knows how to shut guys up. That's
worked
thing.
Well for relationships. I stopped doing stand-up because my life fell apart. I had a nervous breakdown. I went into treatment. I tried to kill myself. I lost everything. And I was focused on getting sober and getting my life together than I was doing a tight 10-minute set at the Comedy Store.
Yeah, yeah.
And also getting newly sober. I didn't want to be around people drinking and smoking pot at 1 in the morning. Then I was in sober living for 2.5 years. You can't be like, hey, can I break curfew? I need to go do, you know, a set in the belly room, you know? And it's like – and also, okay, here's another thing. Yes, nerves were part of it, but I was sober most of the time I did stand-up.
Right. You were sober the night I saw you.
Yeah. Stand-up is based on how broken you are. Poor me.
See,
aren't I pathetic?
This is the thing. This
blah,
is very,
blah, blah.
You got to understand, he's obsessed with comedy.
I am?
Yes. All your friends are comedians. All your friends are
it's
comedians.
True, but it just has happened that way because Carolla and
well, we're smart. We're
yeah,
smart.
Smart.
We're
smart like
and
that.
Self-effacing. But it's like, you know, it was like all my thing was based on how crazy I was and what a terrible wife I was and what a bad drug addict I was. And I just – there's nothing funny about being happy and having your crap together. Nothing. So I just decided – I thought that I had labeled myself – and I needed to break the identity I'd created. And I was like, I need to recast myself. And I want to recast myself as someone who's successful and got their shit together and isn't crazy. And so I started working on that. And then I also – I needed money. So I was freelancing and I was babysitting. And then the book came and it's just kind of taken off from there. And I mean, the book, it's great to have people go, oh, my God, that was hilarious. But nothing beats getting a letter from someone saying – you helped save my life. Your book gave me hope. I'm going into treatment tomorrow. thank you.
That's a big deal.
That's a huge deal. And I just cry. I still get those letters and I cry and cry. To have taken 20 years of self-destructive crap and turned it into a tool that helps people, right. Oh, my God.
Right.
Right.
And you caught my ear a little bit. 2.5 years in sober living. That's interesting.
Yeah, right?
That's
long
what you
hear. Time.
That's
yeah.
what you hear, though, people that are serious and going
to
well, do
I had nowhere to go, either.
Did but, you ever run into Andy Dick?
I saw him at the store. I don't know him. He's a friend of mine. But, do you mean run into him or like running him
in
like
sober,
naked?
No,
I mean,
in, a sober, like? In a sober living house.
No.
Area.
What caught my
he's
ears,
also been living in them off and on for years.
What caught my ear is for a different reason than Andy in sober living. But you were slipping and sliding and then 2.5 years in sober living. Yeah. That's a very different approach to your recovery. Right?
And that's what I recognize.
Years,
and that's
yeah.
what I recognize and – you know, you life is balance, right? So somehow I think you're out over here being very conscious of what you just stated and kind of wanting to get away from the former you.
Which
and
is
eventually
the,
what an authentic existence is the integration
absolutely.
Of both, right? And you're in the process
I
of that.
I completely agree with
right?
that. And that might be from a stand-up stage.
It's hard to be funny about good stuff. It really is. You know what I mean?
You have to be open to the possibility.
It was a problem for Richard Pryor.
What?
Richard Pryor got sober, and it was
– What, then he sucked?
He didn't even try. You know what I mean?
I was sober most of the time I was doing stand-up. I spoke at She Recovers. Right? Mm-hmm. 500 women, Beverly Hilton. I got a standing ovation. It was funny. People were crying. You can do it. You can have a message and be funny. What recovery advocates are funny? That's the way to reach young kids.
Yeah.
They want to know that you can be that you haven't lost your sense of humor and that you can still have fun being sober. And I think that for me, at least, I need to break the shame. I've got to have humor about
it. And just to keep going on the path that Bob has set forth here, why not do both? Stand-up and speaking.
Well, it's hard, though. I understand what she's going through. When she brought it up, and then I thought about it.
Because there's
days
no
afterwards.
Money in stand-up.
When I go to my favorite comedians, Louis, Dave Chappelle, Chris,
Bert Kreischer.
Right?
Bert, too.
Right?
Bert's a friend.
So,
Tom Segura.
The guy that died... That I found after he died, we had his wife on the podcast.
Oh,
that guy's funny as hell. That guy is funny as hell. But it's all very tragic.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all – so is there a Schadenfreude part of the audience who loves comedy? They like being around these losers like Louie and this – you know what I mean? Like is there a Schadenfreude part of the audience of comedy?
Yes, but I think that – people that are really good comedians orchestrate the audience. They're playing the audience. And Ralphie May is what I'm thinking of. I've seen Ralphie May have people crying, like nearly vomiting, but in waves through the audience. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Funny.
I was way on the side of a huge audience of 4,000 people, and I watched it just go like literally
awesome.
Waves through it. And he
but
was
a
just,
lot of it's self-depreciating.
I talked about.
I know.
It's all like, look how fucked
but
up
why
I am.
Do people
and, like,
want to go see a guy who's obviously in pain talk about that pain
because
in
people
a
like
funny
to feel,
way.
Because, first of all, people like to feel better. People like to feel better than you, and people like to laugh, and they like, you know, people like to feel superior. That's it, you know.
Let's break down laughter a little bit for a minute here. They're up on stage, and I'll use Amy as an example. And
I loved how she attacked. She shut this dude down in 2 seconds.
I don't even remember this.
Right.
Yeah.
She's just doing her job.
Yes.
She's just doing her job up there. And she is evoking from the audience this spontaneous, subconscious, visceral, uncontrollable discharge, right? It's not like she's
– it's coming from them, not her.
It's not like she's up there – they're up there going, E=mc². She's making a good point there. No, it's like she is evoking in us collectively and individually these involuntary discharges, right? Which is a pretty
powerful
thing.
Well, a lot of
thing.
What she touched on and why it was – I also described watching her being uncomfortable. It was about how women view their husbands, and all husbands worry – what their wives are really thinking, and she's going to talk about it for 10 fucking minutes and make everybody feel uncomfortable.
Right, right. And,
right?
But then discharge. Have our laughter discharge. And so –
Look at – you knew what you were doing.
Shut up.
Well,
you knew what you were doing.
You're like – you were always very manipulative. I'm like, how dare you?
But right?
I mean, I just...
Well, I had about 10 thoughts at once there. So.
Okay, yeah. Go, I mean, go.
Well, one was...
What is that insecurity that men feel when women are...
Castration anxiety. Okay. That's what it is.
But that's why that marriage... That's part of the reason that marriage is over. Yeah. I don't think that was cool of me to actually make fun of my husband on stage. I think that was disrespectful looking back.
But by building the tension of your castration anxiety and then discharging it with laughter, it makes it all okay. And... Collectively, you're the group, you're the audience, you're setting her up there and giving her the power to do that. Collectively, in a way, we're sort of sacrificing them. They're sort of human sacrifices.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? See? Totally. But she's playing into that human sacrifice and using it in a way that builds the tension and then releases it so you don't want to do the sacrifice anymore.
And does that make for more intimacy? Does it make us understand the human condition better?
Yes. And what do we say she did when it went well?
Killed it.
So there you go. Isn't it weird?
She tried to kill him, by the way.
Well, she's going to cut his
I brandished a knife. It was very Hamlet. I didn't ever try to kill. It didn't even
but
touch
the nuts
him.
Were
Let's
gonna
back
go.
It up.
She was going to cut his nuts off. Really? Right? That's really what that is.
Right.
And that's the tension. What is she thinking of me is sort of how it consciously plays out. It's like, does she think I'm okay? Is she good enough? I'm big enough? Blah, 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 blah. You're right. But that's all sort of weirdly funnels into
castration. How come when
anxiety.
I said you like comedians, all of your friends are comedians. You go to comedy all the time. The only times we've gone out socially as couples were to comedy clubs. And then I bring up comedy. He goes, why would you think that?
Wait, let me just say. Let me just say.
That's funny.
Wait. You invited us to the comedy club.
Oh,
and you love comedy.
I love going. I sure do. We go rarely, though. We almost never go, right?
Christina P is playing tonight. You want to go?
Yes.
She's great. She's great. I love her.
She's at the Comedy Store in LA. If anybody's here,
I will go see anytime.
All right. Okay. So there we have it.
It's also, you know, it's hard to talk about drugs and being sober to a crowd that's drinking, that's got a 2-drink minimum and drinking because they don't want to hear about it. You know, yeah. And it's
I'm trying to think of who are the people that have gotten sober, stand-ups that have gotten sober that were funny. There aren't
any. I don't know
any.
Why. Just read my book and quiet and just tell it. Like, I'm into the writing now.
I understand that.
You know, it's like that's where I can have a message. That's where I don't have – there's not the pressure to be funny all the time. You can be funny when there's places, but you can also be honest and authentic and vulnerable. And I think that that's important. That's the other thing. As a comic, you know, it was – you use comedy to deflect from real emotion and vulnerability all the time. Mm-hmm. It becomes your armor. I was doing it in meetings. I was doing sets in meetings. That's how I learned. That's how I started being a comic. Because I would just—I was so crazy when I was newly sober, shooting coke. I'd start talking. I was so out of my mind, and people—and I was so honest that people were just falling off their chairs laughing. And a couple professional comics came up to me and they just said, "Have you thought about doing stand-up? You're hilarious."
Wow.
Were you manic at the time?
No, no. I'm not bipolar.
She's just incredible.
No, I mean from the cocaine. I just wanted
I was like, okay. So I started doing stand up and I did it for about 5.5 years and I toured and it was great and I got it out of my system and I don't miss it.
But to be fair, aren't there a lot of girls that you went to high school with that are kind of like you? They're just no bullshit.
No.
There's a lot that are acid tongued, no bullshit.
They're not my friends anymore. Believe me. I was the goody.
You went to Westlake?
I went to school in Westlake, but I wasn't friends with those cool girls. I was like a goody two-shoes.
Westlake,
you went to Westlake when it was separate from Harvard.
Yes. Yeah, but it's like I was like a goody two-shoes. I didn't drink until I was 19, so my friends were all like goody two-shoes, and I was like I didn't smoke or drink or kiss anyone until I was like 18. You know what I mean? Nothing. So
were you in Catholic school?
Well, that was before that. And they putting a Jew in Catholic school was interesting.
A Jew in Catholic school?
Yeah, that wasn't good.
Did you go to Catholic school?
No.
But, you know, I was a goody two-shoes, so my crowd, they all got married and had kids and became lawyers, and I became a drug addict.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there was another crowd there of your generation.
That are gnarly.
That tell the fucking truth, shocking
truths. I wasn't friends with those girls.
You
Maybe
know
I need
who
to be friends with those
some
girls.
Some of them
of
are married to some of my friends, right? And it's a whole West Side. It was almost like that empowerment movement that L7 kind of led. Like women are equal to men and they act like men and they fucking confront you and, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was all around that West Side. It all started in Beverly Hills.
I wasn't
friends
with those girls then.
But you know that was going on.
Of course.
I could name names. They're all in AA now, too.
Of course. I know.
What is it about drug addicts and alcoholics, Drew, that they're always – pushing envelope somewhere on the horizon, whether it's gender.
My favorite thing is when people that have deep experience in treating alcoholics and drug addicts go, what is up with these people? What is up with drug addicts and alcoholics? Farina did that to me once. I'm like, Jesus.
Oh, yeah,
if you don't know, come on now. You and I don't know what's going on. So,
but you know what I'm talking about. Look at the history of addicts and alcoholism just in the last 50, 60, 70 years, how much of an impact it had on how we live, right? Rock and roll, comedy. Those are the two cultural things. Hip-hop music, right? Those are all drug-fueled kind of populations, right?
Yeah.
It changes the normal people. It influences the normal people. Well, and then they condemn us. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Ask your question. What is the question?
I think it comes from that insecure place of wanting to prove yourself. That's the only way I know how it manifests. I've got something to say, and I'm going to say it. Right?
Okay.
And that – normal people don't really have that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll give an example. The punk rock yes. movement was fueled by methamphetamine, yes. alcohol, and yes. antisocial personality
yes.
disorder.
Yes.
It changed the entire world's culture.
Yes.
It was only like 200 mentally ill people. And now the ones that didn't die are sober.
So there's a bigger question here that I've thought about. And that is that we went through – see, I think we're still reckoning with – I do a lot of thinking about this stuff. And I really think that the Civil War was a major trauma that we never got through before we hit the Second World War and the First World War. And this was a highly, highly trauma – we put it in the background, but we don't really realize how much trauma that really – between Civil War and Jim Crow and then World War One and then World War Two, I mean, think about how much generational trauma there was with all that. Just profound.
And now hardly any, and then, all we do is talk about
and
it.
And then, well, and then peace and prosperity.
Yeah, that's boom. What I'm talking about.
About 50s, 60s, 70s. That's what I'm talking 70s. About. Then the sexual revolution, and then everyone has money, and then the narcissistic turn. And around 1960, we decided that no longer were we going to listen to people that were smart and had their lives together. We're going to listen to the long-haired sociopath who's screaming at the top of his lungs. That's the guy.
Don't point at me. I wasn't a part of that. I was a part of later on.
I'm actually correct. And I'm thinking about – you're right. I'm not
and
thinking
then
about
we
you.
Were the ones that said, fuck the hippies. Destroy everything.
Exactly. You took it further. That's exactly right. But it continued to be what young people for some reason suddenly elevated as the standard to which they measured themselves, which is very – never. I can't think of another period of history where that happened. Normally people in history –
where young
like,
people are in charge of the culture?
Not in charge.
Or
where
the
they,
thought.
Where they
thought.
Elevated the sickest amongst them.
Mm.
That's whom they elevated. I remember my high school and stuff. We were putting people into positions of authority that were like – the kids could barely function. We wanted them to lead us.
Because they were cool.
They were cool.
They were cool.
And so
they got drunk and they could handle it.
There is something in what you're asking that's sort of bigger, historical. I haven't figured it out yet, but there's something in what you're thinking about. Think globally. Think more historically about it.
But I think of that kind of thing, and then I saw it in comedy in the 90s. I got sober in 96. I saw comedy as this new thing. Like, I had always loved Richard Pryor and George Carlin, whatever. But other than them, there was no comedy revolution going on.
No, in the
90s, all of a sudden, it was like there was a comedy club in every town.
Right, it became a
and
thing.
And there's comedy, and it became a thing, and everybody
became –
But that
was also an antisocial impulse, right?
Is it?
It's
or is it
– like you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, but that's also – you're talking about when comedy was really great in the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah.
Like the 80s was when there wasn't any PC culture and it was like now you can't say anything without pissing someone off.
So you got Kinison. Who do you have in the 80s? Kinison.
Yeah.
Pryor was still lurking around.
Yeah.
But I mean he
– But it was a new breed was Kinison – And who were the other ones?
That whole Chinese restaurant thing in Boston. you know what I'm talking about? Chop Choy or
whatever. Did you play there?
Yeah.
Did you play there, Amy?
No, but just, I mean, it was just, it was a whole different, you know, it's like, now it's like, you can't, there's so much you can't say, and everyone's really tight, and blah, 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 and everything's racist, and everything's,
there's feminism,
and like, even with the recovery thing, you know, I've gotten so much pushback for using the word junkie in my title.
All right, hold that thought. We're taking a break. Be right back. One of the most crucial components of addiction recovery is accountability. Part of what makes addiction so difficult is the inability to self-regulate. Now, this is especially problematic for those in outpatient recovery or pain management program. And while the facilities require regular urine tests to ensure compliance, frequently the actual tests are not even observed. And this led to an epidemic of falsified samples where patients either use someone else's urine or widely available synthetic urine. The result is a lot of addicts carry right on using undetected, and they get none of the benefits from treatment. The only objective test we have for addiction is the urine screen. Now, recently, I learned about a new solution that virtually eliminates the possibility of faking tests, even in facilities where they are unobserved. This is called ToxProtect, a DNA-verified drug test and lab service that provides 100% sample authenticity. ToxProtect was created by Genetox Labs, can be used in place of any standard urine drug test. It starts with simple one-time cheek swab to establish the patient's identity. Once submitted, each subsequent screening uses DNA testing to verify that that sample matches the patient. And additionally, ToxProtect screens for synthetic urine and irregular values that would indicate dilution or other adulteration. In other words, this pretty much guarantees accountability. I'm excited to see this service being used, and I think it will significantly improve an addict's chances for successful recovery. I'm going to be talking more about Genetox Labs and ToxProtect on future shows. Thankfully, ToxProtect is being used by more and more facilities every day. Be sure to ask for it by name wherever you or your loved one is receiving care. To get more information or share it with your facilities, go to drdrew.com/ToxProtect. That is drdrew.com/ToxProtect.
Welcome I'm back. On the air. I got an emergency text from my rehab.
Uh-oh.
Bob, I need to talk to you immediately ASAP. It's important. I can wait 20 minutes.
Oh, boy.
Someone might die. It's fine.
No. You can't – when you own a rehab, you can't live in fear that somebody's going to die there or you'll never sleep.
You know what? If you don't have a crew that can't handle it, if you don't have employees, then you don't have the right
people. You've got to have faith in your employees.
Right.
You know? That's another way that I know Amy is from rehab world.
Well, so –
because she was married to a rehab owner, a friend of mine, mm-hmm. acquaintance of mine, mm-hmm. and that's where we really became close and – you know, she knows the underbelly of the rehab.
Yeah,
world.
I'm actually writing a piece for The Fix about patient brokering now.
It's so brutal. That's just the most.
What's going on? It's so disgusting.
But that's just the most disgusting, obvious piece of the mess, right? There's so many layers.
Oh, I know. Believe me, I've talked to people.
Google making more money off the death of addicts is the most
disgusting. I'm going to talk to your boy Chuck, too.
Yeah. So Google makes billions, not millions, billions of dollars off the manipulation of Google searches for healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah. They make the most money.
It makes the rehabs look like petty things.
Didn't even think about that. You're right.
Right?
The word junkie before the break.
Okay,
My Fair Junkie is the book.
So My Fair Junkie is
the book.
What did the politically correct crowd suggest you call it?
Well, okay.
My Fair Drug Addict?
My Fair Substance Use Disorder?
Yes, exactly. My publishers were great with it. My agent was great with it. You know, they were like, you know, because if it bleeds,
title.
It leads. You know, I've written editorial. You know, people grab the book because it said junkie. So then, after it came out,
My Fair Lady? Do they have to be explained that millennials? I think they do.
Here's the deal:
It's a transformation story.
It's a Pygmalion story.
Oh, they absolutely would not know Pygmalion either. But let me just say that I firmly believe that all this bullshit focus on nomenclature amplifies stigma.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So
it's all the codependent do-gooders that are – it's not drug addicts that are doing this.
No, there are, though. There are recovery advocacy groups who are saying –
they're called recovery advocates,
Drew. Yeah, and they're saying, you know, you should say substance use disorder. Junkie is stigmatizing.
Who are these people?
They're people that
– I guarantee you they're either on replacement – or do-goody codependents.
I would say most of them aren't sober, but they work in recovery.
Mm.
A lot of them.
I don't know.
Because they don't understand drug addiction.
Okay.
What group is it? I'm looking them up. What's it called?
Recovery Advocates.
Is that the name of a
group? No, I'll give it to you after. I don't want to name names.
It's that group.
Yeah, it's a group.
That's a bunch of codependents.
Oh, is that what you're saying it is?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, it was a couple. I got it from a couple different. I got pushback from a couple different areas. I got it on Instagram. I got it from one recovery advocacy group, and I got it from a group in Canada.
Canada is a whole different can of worms.
And so I just wrote a piece, and I was just like, you know,
let's reclaim the drug addict's privilege at using words to describe.
You don't
their
get to tell me how to tell my story, exactly. And it's like for me to. I don't know anyone in recovery who says I have substance use disorder.
No,
not
of course
one person.
Not.
And I interviewed an addictionologist and a psychiatrist who's also sober, who used to run rehabs, and he said even at my height of my drinking and drug use, I did not fit the criteria for substance use disorder. He goes, that is for.
That's for research.
That's for charging the insurance companies.
That's right.
All that kind of stuff. And he goes, and that's not going to break the stigma. People are going to go, Steve has substance use disorder. I don't give a shit. He still owes me $200 and stole my car.
What breaks the stigma is being honest about the condition and joke and making light, but looking at the humor within.
Yes, and showing that you can recover, breaking the stigma of recovery, breaking the stigma of addiction.
It
was like, that's what I said. And I was like, owning it has made me feel free.
Those people really need to be set back on their heels. I'm sorry, but they do.
And it's like, and don't tell me how to tell my story. Are you out of your mind?
Well,
But you know what? They said, it's using some highfalutin word like substance use disorder, like SUD is not going to – like AIDS,
I just laugh
AIDS,
at
AIDS
it.
Had a highfalutin scientific name. For a long time, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, here's
autoimmune deficiency disorder. Guess what broke the stigma for AIDS? What broke the stigma for AIDS?
What?
Magic Johnson talking about it.
And that it was no longer a death sentence.
Right.
And AIDS rides and AIDS stigma and all of that other stuff.
People just talking about it.
Yes.
But let me tell you.
And people getting hope and people saying, oh my God, that's a death sentence.
You gotta appreciate how people are coming into this field, Drew. They're coming in for their do-gooder codependency, right? They're licensed social workers, licensed marriage and family therapists, IDs. Most of them nowadays are not sober people. Mm-hmm. They are people who want to help or want to get involved in the helping field, right? And so I just pick the ones that I think know what's up, and I educate them simply on that because they're the one they're teaching that term the last 5 years in school.
Oh, now saying, even APA is like for articles you have to say person with addiction or person.
Yeah,
okay. And I'm like, oh,
so
God,
listen
you
to
can't
this.
Say addict.
So
you
this
can't
is what I say. I say, okay, if the people in our facility have substance use disorder. That suggests that there are some people who
Mortally
can use,
use
methamphetamine or heroin. Mm-hmm. Orderly.
And not only that.
Dave from Dope Nation said that there's orderly use.
Have you ever – he stole that from me. Have you ever met anybody that's used methamphetamine orderly and correctly?
Not only that.
You should see the look on a smart licensed social worker is like – they realize they've been lied to for 2.5 years in school.
What do you have to say? Because I would have thought you would.
Yes, not only that, they. What drug addict? When you were in your disease, did you care about with nomenclature? Think about it. Did that determine whether you embrace sobriety or not? It has zero to do with freaking anything.
Yes,
zero.
Yeah,
think about it.
except
one thing. I'll tell you one thing.
Political correctness.
I'll tell you one thing. When we all shared a language, it was a way to connect and joke and to have a gallows humor about you being a junkie. Hey, man, junkie.
Right.
Come on. Who are you talking to? You're a junkie.
Like he was going to steal my book and you were like, don't, you're a junkie. Don't steal the book.
Right.
Yeah. But now there's all this splintering among all the things. It's like, let's all just
But
we're
I
all
think
going
it's truly because there's a lot of people both in and out of that are hovering around the recovery racket, right? Who are both sober or not sober, who I don't think have the disease of addiction.
I agree with you.
Right? So it's now been – this is part of my thing about the 12-step world, Drew.
Yeah.
You got people in there that are definitely not alcoholics acting like they're in charge of it. Whenever you challenge them, you're the devil. You're this bad person. You're the one who thinks too much or questions too much. So I just stopped fighting like 8 or 10 years ago.
Who would go to rehab unless they were an alcoholic?
there's lots of people. They have emotional issues. They have no place to live.
Really?
I mean, there's a lot of people. I know you would never go.
Jesus.
Look at the look on her face. She would never go, no matter what. Yeah. And then she can't imagine
It's like five-star chefs. Because some of them are really nice, you know? Yeah. But, I mean, Bob, I'm in 12-step, and it's okay, that's the other thing.
Too.
I totally blow 11th tradition, and I know someone who wouldn't blur my book because it blew 11th tradition.
Yeah.
And I was just like,
yeah.
And I just said,
don't try.
Yes.
They do not know what they're talking about.
I know. What was I talking about? Oh, 11th tradition. 11th tradition, okay, that's in the 30s. Okay, yeah. Now we have intervention. We have celebrity rehab. We have,
sure do.
You know, South Park doing stuff about AA. We have, it's in Love, Judd Apatow show. It's everywhere.
You are sentenced to AA in the courts.
Yeah, but it's like we know about it. If you say you're in recovery, people assume you're in a 12-step. So, like, how is it secretive? Yeah, being weirdly secretive about it and not talking about it is, again, adding to that creepy stigma about recovery, that it's not okay to be in recovery. Recovery was the hardest thing I ever did over and over and over again. And it's like, you know, I'm proud of it. And it's like, you know what? I wrote about AA in the book, and I wrote about some of the sexual predatory creepy behavior that happens in the rooms, and I wrote about really honestly stuff. And some girl said to me, you seem cool, and you made AA not seem like a weird Christian cult. I want to meet you at a meeting.
Oh, that's good.
And I said, okay. And she met me at a meeting, and she's fucking sober now.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm with you.
I understand. That's,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
So 11th tradition, that's fucking outdated. That was the 30s.
Well, you should know that Bob and I did a whole study in that 11th tradition before we did celebrity rehab.
It's not the world we live in anymore.
I agree, but people get really bent about it.
It was Bill W.'s wife that pushed it. Remember all that stuff
she wrote? She wrote a book called there's a lot of history to the 11th tradition. My belief is that AA is now not just a self-help support network. It is a religion. There are people within it that treat it like religion.
I agree.
Unquestionable
Bob,
authority.
Bob, I agree
when
with
I
that.
Was on the
oh, God,
I,
here we go.
So avoid
here
those
we go.
Meetings.
Here we go. Here we go. I was on General Services when they were doing the new edition of the book, right? The LA chapter on Wilshire when they had the offices there. And I just suggested that the LA chapter suggests to General Services that To the Wives be removed from the big book Alcoholics Anonymous because it is misogynist, is outdated, and it no longer is useful.
Right.
You should have seen the religious blowback against that suggestion that you touch their text. Moses gave from down
Bob,
on the mountain.
Bob, you're acting like I don't go to meetings. You're acting like I don't know. But you know what? You can pick and choose. You know, there are some good tools there. It's really cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy.
Regardless of all that, it's still the only game in town. It's the only thing that works.
No, but it's cognitive behavioral therapy. Throw out all the religious crap. Throw out our creator.
I'm not saying you guys misinterpreted what I'm saying by religion. I wasn't comparing it to religion.
Look, there's a religious
it was
intensity.
How people view it.
The religious
that
intensity
it's
around
unquestionable
it.
Authority.
I agree with you.
And they make up the things that they say are unquestionable, like the 11th tradition or To the Wives.
But I would argue that one of the reasons is that the religious stuff around it is it's always
religious
been a
fervor
feeling.
Not religion.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And remember what we used to come up against when with
psychiatry.
Yeah,
has
with
psychiatry
stuff. Yeah. And so people have bizarre
dogmatic beliefs.
Bizarrely almost like they're talking about a religion or something the way they talk about it.
Well, there's also the tribalism that comes into
there's
the
all
whole
kinds
thing.
Of weird stuff around it. And my thing is like, hey buddy, this is just something that's worked. It's worked the way it is.
Right.
It's worked for a lot of people. It's free.
Yeah.
For Christ's sake, it's free.
Right.
And you talk about saving healthcare dollars and
let's
just put it in the lineup here with the things we're doing. You're right, it is fundamentally a piece of it is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Correct.
Another piece is attachment. You're sitting with your sponsor. Another piece is trauma management, fourth and fifth step. You know, so there's all kinds of stuff that
if you take it apart, it's really
and
it's,
John Kelly wrote some publications on this where he showed that it works just like all the other treatments we use. It works the same way. Magically, an empiric model, it works just the way other empiric models work. And it's, you know, it's not professional.
But it's free and it's not professional.
It's free, it's not professionally managed. There's some downside.
Right.
But
there's crazies in charge of
that's right.
Whatever, so
but
it's like,
but
know.
It is something that needs to be put in the lineup for sure in terms of the things we use to treat addiction.
Right.
Free. Free. And the big thing, you know what the big thing is about recovery is you don't have enough people around to sit on addicts. They're not professional to sit on the addict day in and day out the way they need. The way they need. Particularly early in recovery. You have to sit on that person.
Yeah.
And only a person who was sat upon themselves is motivated to do that to keep themselves sober and to help others.
True.
And there are not enough professionals on earth to do that, let alone enough money to do it. It's like, you know, the second inaugural, all the bondsmen and all the lashes and all the whatever of the land will be run dry just trying to keep one addict sober when there's this free service out there. You said something about the Dopey Boys?
Dopey Nation. No, he gave you credit, Bob. He gave you credit.
I was strangely
calm down.
Worrying about him today. I don't know. I had a weird –
Dave? Really?
I was thinking about Chris. Chris the other guy, right?
Chris is the guy that died.
I was thinking about Chris a lot today for some reason. And I asked you. That's why I asked you about it.
Chris is dead.
I understand Chris is dead.
Maybe you were conjuring up his spirit. He kept shutting down the computer.
Yeah, maybe we should try to get Chris on your podcast.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
Too soon.
But Dave, you know, he was so connected to Chris.
I know.
Right? And it's becoming more and more. There's, you know, we'll see how the next 6 months goes. That's how I always think. But we talked to him. I talked to him. You talked to him.
Yeah, I talked to him.
The Milwaukee guys talked to him.
Yeah.
He's staying close. He tells you if he's having a good day or a bad day.
No, I love him. You know,
Dave?
So it's like,
yeah.
No, he's a good guy.
No, he's sweet.
We're going to go see him at
Cats. He texts me every other day.
At what?
And I loved Dopey Nation. Half of their listeners are still high. So you know, he's told me that. So he's like, you know, tell us your worst stories.
Hey, those are the
Amy.
People we want to get at, by the way.
Right. Yeah. He's like, tell us your stories. Don't lecture. Like, tell us your stories. Tell us your most horrible stories. I'm like, okay, I met my drug dealer at Cedar Sinai when I was having an outpatient procedure and I did lines in the cancer bathroom. And I felt so bad. It was like a sign over the toilet. It was like, flush twice if you're having chemo. And I didn't have cancer. And I'm like, people are fighting for their lives, Amy, and you're doing lines of blow in the cancer bathroom.
Did you really feel bad in the moment or in retrospect?
No, I felt bad at the moment. I felt like, you're a piece of shit, Amy.
Just
like,
hurry
you
up. Really, just don't take too long.
And then you thought, fuck that.
Yeah, I was just like, whatever, guys. You know? And then that was the other thing. When I one of the treatments I did was I went down to Tijuana and I had amino acids pumped into my arm, right?
You know about this?
So they were
supposed to,
you know this?
NAD?
It's 10 grand.
Oh, the old amino acids. Now they
This was the hit center.
Well, now
this
we have NAD. That actually works.
Really?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, this did not work. And I'm there. And I was like, it was the ideal thing for a drug addict. I'm like, I get to sit in my sweatpants on my phone while someone fixes my brain and I don't have addiction. I'm like, this is wonderful, right? And other people are there for like MS and cancer. Yeah. They're like, what are you here for? I'm like, cocaine abuse. I was just like, I felt such a
dick. You remember that? They were doing it back when
they were doing it.
Do you know?
You know who I love pointing out? So one of the greatest musicians in the world who died tragically, Elliot Smith, right?
Oh, God.
So he had
been
to several treatments and it was very
needle
sad.
In the hay. Oh,
and
brutal.
He got that treatment, the amino acids, from that famous doctor at the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills, who you know who I'm talking about.
God, it
was a new gimmick, the amino acids. And then Elliot had an upswing in his mood, right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't suicidal, right? Which he had before when he got sober.
Mm-hmm.
You have a pink cloud.
I've never had a pink anything. Look at me.
But you know what I'm saying. He was in a good groove, but the doctor convinced him it was because amino acids. So he started being the face of amino acid treatment.
Of course.
And did interviews talking about this miracle treatment for addiction and depression.
Oh, boy.
And then a couple of years later, we know what happened.
Of course.
Very sad.
Do you know what has really changed my mood and my sobriety?
What is?
And I wrote a piece about, for The Fix, is about low dopamine toning. You'll know about this, about the genetic mutation for some addicts.
The D2 receptor.
So we can't make L-methylfolate. Properly.
Well, that's what and your D2 receptors are different. So there's a lot of different things.
Yeah,
well,
so,
the genetics around alcoholism addiction are very complex.
Yes.
If you see a single explanation, be very
okay,
skeptical.
But it was – you can test for this one
I think it's called like the motherfucker mutation. Sorry, but
It looks like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and
The medical thing looks like that.
Yeah. And it's like it is. If you don't have that, so it's like for these for people like us, you can't get make L-methylfolate as easily from folic acid and folate like from greens. And so you've got a low dopamine tone and blah blah. So
they're extrapolating to that, but the folate issue is for real.
I started taking L-methylfolate. Mm. Bam.
Helped you.
I feel normal.
Oh, did you get measured for the gene?
No. Yeah. I was shooting stuff in my arm. Some Mexican guy spit out on a corner. You think I'm going to take get
oh, no,
measured
for the later.
Gene?
I was like,
let's roll the dice here.
Yeah, and it worked.
Let's see if it works.
And it worked amazingly.
And what is,
I mean, I think
over
that we need
counter?
To really look into that. For
oh, listen, this is the thing about addiction. The legitimate sort of criticism of addiction treatment is that by using 12-step facilitated therapies,
right.
we're always accused of one size fits all.
Right.
And to some extent, that's true.
Right.
When in reality, what we should be using is an array,
absolutely,
and that we skillfully either try or know how to apply to a specific patient. Suboxone, as you have discussed, for some people may be right.
Right.
Ethyl, you know, the folic acid may be right for some people.
But I still needed CBD to not be a total asshole also. Do you know what I mean? Like I needed the connection. I needed how to behave. I needed to do contrary action, all of that.
The cognitive behavioral therapy, yes. The CBT. You said CBD.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But to be fair, CBD may be something we end up using
well,
in our
what
army.
What was your thing about
cannabinoids?
It doesn't even make CBD.
No. You and Sharp were talking about it. The low dose, like low dose LSD, but the low dose...
I don't know. I talk about a lot of things because I'm looking for stuff.
But
the thing
that he wants to have the drips of.
Oh, ketamine.
Ketamine.
That's for mood. That's for mood stuff.
That's for what?
For mood.
How low
for depression.
A dose?
Oh, really no. It's five heavy infusions. Five in anesthesia. Heavy.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Oh, I thought – what about the low-dose microdosing?
That's LSD. It's microdosing LSD. That's treating PTSD, I think, more than mood. And that, we don't know the long-term effects of that.
Mm.
Ketamine has been pretty well studied now. But be that as it may, I'm not sure it's good for addicts, though, obviously, for obvious reasons. But the point is the one-size-fit-all criticism is just – however, I do – think that 12-step should always be a piece of what we're using.
I agree with you.
And the rest
is
the other thing.
Integrate.
And
at the center. Here's the question.
At the center, and making recovery possible.
What's the first question an addict asks within the first 72 hours of being in a treatment center? Are you sober? It is the most important ingredient in helping another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. All the rest needs to build around that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Meaning nutrition and hippy-dippy, should I call it, and CBT. And yes, the psychiatric community has some component of it, but what they tried to do is just replace us.
Right.
And
that's
get the
sober people out of it.
You can't treat it like complete mental illness. I mean, I've been on every medication.
Everything became medical. I'm talking about the heart and soul of treatment centers
moved away from the fact is what I have that you want is I know how to live sober.
Well, yeah.
Right?
We still
that
need
doesn't
that.
Exist in so many rehabs.
Oh,
you
know
that.
I know that. But, you know, you're asking me what – on your podcast, how I had this shift and how can we create this shift.
So
I was sweeping the streets. I'm on a chain gang, right? Sweeping the streets on a chain gang and no one will talk to me. You know, I'm a Beverly Hills princess. So when I showed up there, I was like, oh my God, like these are criminals. And what am I doing here? And it was like, turned out I had more time than anyone else. I was the only one there for violent assault. And it was like a really, it was really an awakening.
Dress them for not having insurance and they got a car accident.
They got a DUI.
Yeah.
She's like.
Yeah. It was really humbling.
She tried to kill her husband with the heel of her shoe.
You know, and it was like, you know, no one talked to us except for. Like homeless drunk people were like, good morning, you know, stay out of the pen, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, wherein other people were
stay
kind of like,
stay out of the pen. Amy was being told to stay out of the pen by homeless people on Hollywood Boulevard.
But it was like,
you know, normal people were like, oh, because we had a clean team outfit on and all this stuff in the room. Yeah. And so, you know, it was like a couple people, you know, dumb people would be like, I love the environmentalism you're doing. How do I become part of this?
Are you filming a reality show or something? Is that what's happening?
So, but I had a moment where I was sweeping the streets and I just thought, wait a second. I'm in my early 40s, right? And I've been in six treatment centers and I've tried to kill myself three times. Wow. And I've been in four psych wards, 5150, and I've had numerous relapses. And I had been sort of a trust fund baby, married to a rich guy, left with nothing. And I'm in sober living and I'm sweeping the streets. And I just went, wait a second. This can be the best thing that ever happened to me, or this can be the worst thing that ever happened to me. And it's my decision. And I thought, this is the result of all your decisions, Amy, your consequences, your character. You're not a victim here. Could this be the best thing that ever happened to you? And if so, how? And I thought, well, yeah, like I can learn to sweep and I can really learn, like have a work ethic and I can get humble and blah, 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 blah. And I embraced it. And I also found the fun because I was like, you have 30 days of this, honey, so you better find what's fun in this.
So it's a moment of clarity, right? Yeah. And there's a small little pamphlet called The Enchiridion by Epictetus where he suggests that kind of philosophy as a way of dealing healthily with life.
It made a shift and I've never gone back.
Get her a copy of The Enchiridion. I think you get it for like nothing. Even. You guys, we got to wrap it up.
All right. Well, very, that was beautiful. Fun. See, you're a recovery advocate, not a stand-up comedian.
I'm both.
Oh, there you go. She's both.
But we need to do a little campaign against the powers that be that are undermining the culture of people with their disease, owning their disease.
That's how you break the shame.
Correct. The codependents are appropriating. They're culturally appropriating your disease. Yeah. Don't let it happen.
I know. All right.
All right,
you guys. See you next time.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC, being Lawrence Savon, 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. You can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Sing One I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, at his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, DRW, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message, join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. Also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at doctor.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.